All right, good morning, everybody. February 8th, 11:10 a.m. Tuesday. We're doing Chem 12A, back for lecture. And I was just saying I needed to get that recording going because I forget to record when I start talking too much and I get going in the morning, the introductions. Let's see, what do I have for announcements? Not much. Quiz from last week was graded on Sunday-ish. I think everybody turned it in and got it graded and got it back, which is great. Most of the scores are really good on that. There was a few things, few issues with formal charge, few issues with the octet rule. The octet rule was one of the main things that I saw that people had made mistakes on in terms of the Lewis structures in violating the octet rule. We need to remember that that elements that are in period one and period two are held to the octet rule because they don't have d orbitals. D orbitals don't start until period three. And it's not until you get to period three elements and below that they can start to violate that octet rule. They can go to 10, 12, 14 electron exceptions. But in period one and two, which includes carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, those three elements must abide by the octet rule and cannot go over eight electrons. So something to watch for as we go through those things. We had our first SI session last Friday. I need to speak with Chloe and see when she has the next ones arranged for. But I did put a new tab into the chemed.study webpage. And maybe I'll show you where that is real quick. I'm trying to think of how I can do that. Let me do a file new window. I'll move it over here. I'll screen share that window for a minute and just show you where that is so that people can see it. Share basic, Safari. And so what I did is off the main page, when you go to Chem 12AL, there is now a access materials tab in the literature resources. And under that access materials, I'll start documenting all of the materials that are used at access so that everybody has access to them. And I'll link them in the Canvas shell as well. I just haven't gotten a chance to do that yet. And so the problem set is there. And that problem set goes through formal charge. It goes through Lewis structures. It goes through hybridization and figure out the hybridization of certain atoms. It goes through bond length, indicate which bond is longer. And then in addition to that, I broke the key out from it and put the key in a separate file. So you actually have to go looking for the key, but it's all there. And the full explanation of how to go through and answer those things is there too. So it's all detailed out. So that's good. We'll keep that running throughout the semester as well. And as new SI materials are used, I'll take those SI materials for people who can't make it to the SI sessions and get them up there as well. All right. Let me stop that share. Let's take us back to here. And let's go ahead and jump into lecture. So that was the brief announcements component. I should ask if anybody has any questions regarding anything in the class and what's going on. Give you guys a second to think about anything. And maybe not, maybe everything's going just fine and you guys are doing hunky-dory. And that's okay too. All right, I am seeing a few less people coming into lecture, which does start to concern me as we go forward because we start a little slow and then things go off the rails here fairly quickly as we start getting into more significant content. Today is gonna be a little bit of an example of how things can start to ramp up fairly quickly. And I think that these live lectures are important in your ability to ask questions. So for those that are here and participating, good job, outstanding. For those of you who are watching at home or watching at another time, I strongly encourage you to think about trying to attend in a live session if you can. Or if you can't, getting some FaceTime with me during office hours. that's going to be really critical. The ability to ask questions in this class is critical to making sure that you understand the information, or that I'm explaining the information fully in a way that that suits your learning style. So that's as much as I can, as strongly as I can encourage that. All right, so I was looking over the notes and thinking about where I wanted to start today. And there's a few things that I want to clean up before moving on to the next section. There's a few things that I was looking back over the material and the homework sets in problem in chapter one that that dealt with boiling points, melting points, intermolecular attractive forces. And so I thought that I would hit that real quick before moving on to this next section, because it still ends with the structures that we've been dealing with and the dipole moments and that type of thing that we were doing. So let's do intermolecular forces really quick before moving on. And this is really because these are things that are review still, that should be working knowledge from Chem 1A, Chem 1B, particularly Chem 1B. We modify them a little bit as we go into Chem 12. So the first thing is those van der Waals forces. And looking at what we call a homologous series. I think I did that wrong. There we go. OGUS. Homologous series. A homologous series is where we take a molecule and we add CH2 each time. So what we can do is we can take or sometimes it's the CH3, I guess, if I'm going from methane to ethane, but as soon as I get from ethane to propane to butane to pentane to hexane, I'm adding CH2 each time. I'm adding 14 molecular weight each time. And what we can look at is we can look at the boiling point in degrees Celsius versus the number of carbons, and increasing the number of carbons. And when we look at CH4 versus C2.
Quick question. Is homologous series, is that an intermolecular force somehow?
No, homologous series is a type of series. It just means that we're going to look at a series of compounds that are all identical. They're just increasing the number of carbons in the molecule each time.
Okay, all right. It was just under the intermolecular force section, so I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't missing something.
No, you're not. And this is the intermolecular force section, because what we're doing is we're looking at how the intermolecular forces increase as we increase the number of carbons. So you're absolutely correct. It's not that homologous series means that it's a different force. It's that what we see is the increase of those forces as we move forward in increasing the number of carbons, that the actual force between the molecules increases. So we look at C2H6, C3H8, C4H10. What we find is that these compounds, as we increase in the number of carbons, continue to increase linearly in their boiling points. And the reason that they're increasing linearly in their boiling points, and that we can plot them in their boiling points, has to do with those van der Waals forces. That when we look at a molecule, maybe I'll do it this way first, that that molecule as a chain has van der Waals forces. And those van der Waals forces, if you recall what your van der Waals forces are, London forces, oftentimes referred to as London dispersion forces or nonpolar forces. These forces are what's the best way to put it? Temporarily perturbed electrostatic forces, where the electron cloud is morphed, polarizable, simply because as one electron, if I think about it this way, this is the way that I normally explain van der Waals forces, is that if we think about an electron cloud as being a spherical thing, and this is the electron cloud, and this is another electron cloud, another molecule, and as they come together and approach each other, like charges repel. So electrons being both negative repel one another and they push each other away. So what happens is the electrons that are here see these electrons coming and these guys move out of the way. And so what happens is if this is the nucleus, the electron cloud literally morphs and moves away from the center of the nucleus such that I get a partial minus and partial positive and a small, what is called induced dipole. The other element or molecule that is coming towards that and sees that, the electron cloud of that one morphs because it sees the developing partial positive, and so it morphs in response to that developing partial positive, and it makes its own little dipole. And therefore, what we get is we get a small attractive force. And it's a small, attractive electrostatic force.
Okay, so just make sure I understand. The van der Waals force is where you have two atoms and they are both, they both have a, like, a partial charge, and those two partial charges cause attraction?
What happens is it is not a single atom. It can be, but it can be a molecule. And the electron cloud originally is evenly distributed. And so there is no partial positive or partial negative to begin with. But as two atoms come together or two molecules come together, the electrons on one see the electrons on the other coming towards them and they move out of the way and they induce a dipole. The induced dipole is not permanent. The induced dipole is temporary and gives a small electrostatic attraction between partial positive and partial negative. And then when they float away from each other, they go back to being evenly distributed. So the van der Waals forces are temporary permutations to the electron cloud that bring about a very small partial minus and partial positive and bring about an attractive force.
Jason, a question real quick before you move on. I think I understand what you're saying by the induced dipole. Can you explain one more time what's the diagram on the right to it? What is that? What's the difference between those two?
The difference between this diagram on the left and this diagram on the right?
No, that one on the right, but between the two little circles, are they the same thing? Where it says induced dipole and there's an atom above and then there's another one to the right. Is it the same picture?
No, they are not the same picture. They are two atoms here that have the nucleus in the center with the electron cloud evenly distributed.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. The other one.
And to the right, what happens is now I have two atoms or two molecules with a nuclei, and they are showing an attractive force where I am getting partial positive to partial negative, and that constitutes the attractive force between the two atoms or the two molecules.
Oh, they're two atoms interacting with each other.
Exactly.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
They're representing the attractive force between the two atoms or two molecules.
Oh, okay, that makes sense, thank you.
And what happens is, when those molecules are small, for instance, we have, let's say, just two methanes, and we look at two methane molecules coming together, the amount of area that these two molecules can interact is fairly small because the surface area and the electron cloud is fairly small. So the amount of area that can happen here is very small for the attractive force. But then when I go to increasing the number of carbons in the molecule, as I increase the number of carbons, the attractive area and force increases. And so as that increases, what happens is you can think of it like Velcro. When you have two small Velcro strips, the attraction between the two pieces of Velcro is minimal. But if I stretch that Velcro out to a much longer length of Velcro, then the attractive force, the force that is required to pull the two pieces of Velcro apart, becomes greater. And so I always think of this as sort of like model Velcro. Increased area equals increased force. And so what happens is, as we go up in a homologous series and we add carbons, we're adding additional mass, yes, but more than the additional mass, we're adding additional area for attractive forces. And so when we look at these boiling points, one of the things that we can do is that we can look at methane, ethane, propane, butane, pentane, and I'll just go hexane too. And these, their boiling points are minus 164, minus 89, minus 42. And then butane goes to zero. Pentane is 36 degrees Celsius. And hexane is 69. So these are all in degrees Celsius in terms of the list. And if you plot those on a graph, they make a fairly linear graph of boiling points for each one of those molecules. And so those all have to do with van der Waals forces. But then what happens when we take a molecule and we branch a molecule? So let's say that we look at a couple of molecules that that may be nonpolar, but may be branching. So here, what we're looking at is pentane C5. Oh, it takes so long to do it this way. This is becoming painful. We're going to fix this today so that this isn't so painful anymore. That's on the agenda for today. Pentane, 2-methylbutene. Oops, butane, not butene. Sorry. And then the last one that I want to look at is 2,2-dimethylpropane. And so these are all isomers. They all have the same formula. They are all C5H12. But the amount of branching increases with each one. And as that branching increases, what we find for their boiling points, I'll put them over here, is that this one was the 36 degrees Celsius. It's actually 36.1. So I include that decimal. As I go to the 2-methylbutane, it goes to 27.9. And as I go to the 2,2-dimethylpropane, it falls to 9.5. So what's going on here? If these are all C5H12 and they all have the same number of carbons and hydrogens, why is my boiling point changing? And what's actually happening? Right? If we go back to this model and we say that the longer the linear molecule is, the more attractive force there is. And the attractive force is related to the boiling point. The stronger the attractive force, the higher the boiling point. So if we say stronger attractive force, equals higher boiling point, then what we could do is we could look at this and we can say, well, obviously the attractive force is less for the 2,2-dimethylpropane. It has to have a lower attractive force. And then we go back to that model that said, well, the more Velcro there is, the higher the attractive force. That means that this model, whatever is going on here, there must be less attractive force. And that's what branching is doing. Branching is decreasing the surface area. And as the surface area decreases, what we can do is we can take a look at it and we can say, right, the amount of surface area that's here for molecular interaction is the length of the molecule. But as the molecule starts to branch, the molecule becomes smaller. And the length of Velcro of interaction, the ability for two molecules to interact becomes less. So when I look at these linear molecules, 2, 3, 4, 5, 2, 3, 4, 5, the amount of interaction between the molecules is such that there's a lot of surface area. But as I start to branch it, then what happens is between these two molecules, there's just less area between them for them to interact with attractive forces. And as I go to a branched molecule that looks like this, now it's almost as if they are spherical, and the amount of area that's between them for them to interact is really small. So branching decreases surface area. And branching decreases attractive forces. That's probably the hardest one, because most of us never really had a good grasp on van der Waals forces to begin with, but then understanding how branching can affect the van der Waals forces is probably the most complicated of the different intermolecular attractive forces. Dipole-dipole was always a little bit easier for people. And so I think that as we go and look at other attractive forces like dipole-dipole, that it becomes a little bit easier to understand that if we take a molecule, again, I'm shortcutting my drawings. I'll stick with expanded drawings for a little bit longer. And then we'll show you how to do it a little bit easier. It'll be a little bit easier to keep up. So if I compare these two molecules, this is isobutylene and acetone. And I look at their melting points and boiling points, that the melting point is minus 140.3 degrees Celsius and the boiling point is minus 6.9 degrees Celsius. And on acetone, my melting point is going to be minus 94.9 degrees Celsius and my boiling point 56.3, a positive 56.3 degrees Celsius. So what is the difference here in looking at what's happening between these two molecules? Why does acetone have significantly higher melting points and significantly higher boiling points? Any ideas? Has to do with the differences between the two molecules in that this one is nonpolar and is using van der Waals forces. And this one is polar, dipole-dipole. So what happens is there's a very small dipole moment, partial minus to partial positive for that molecule. However, the dipole moment here is massive. And that massive dipole moment means that this one acts more like a little bar magnet. And those dipole-dipole forces then are stronger forces that require more energy to pull the two molecules apart from one another in order to increase the degrees of freedom for the melting point and then again for the boiling point. And so the higher the temperature, the more energy that is required and the stronger the intermolecular attractive forces. So we could say here, stronger intermolecular attractive forces require more energy for phase transitions. And therefore, having the stronger intermolecular attractive forces of dipole-dipole, acetone requires more energy to go through those phase transitions. And that more energy translates to a higher melting point or higher boiling point. Clarissa, yeah.
I wanted to ask, so when it comes to the Celsius with the numbering of MP and then BP, with those numbers, are those set as a certain number that's what they're supposed to be? Like it's conceptual, those are conceptual numbers that I guess that apply, that are rules. I guess I'm just trying to understand like how you got the numbers.
Those numbers are from experiment. And so what we do is we take a sample of acetone at normal atmospheric pressure and we increase its temperature until we witness it boiling. And when it boils at a constant temperature until all the material is boiled away. And we can measure that with a thermometer. And at atmospheric pressure, one atmosphere, the boiling point of acetone is 56.3 degrees Celsius. So it's not a calculated number. It's not a conceptual number. It's a real data point for that material, for the boiling point of that material as physically observed by experiment.
Okay, cool. That actually makes a lot of sense.
Awesome. All right, so after dipole-dipole, the next thing that we get into is hydrogen bonding. So hydrogen bonding is sort of dipole-dipole on extreme. It has some other implications in it. Usually what hydrogen bonding implies is that we have a very electronegative atom. That is bound to the hydrogen. So we can think of this as a big electronegative atom. And what that does is that pulls electron density away from the hydrogen, and it makes a very strong dipole moment. So that makes this hydrogen very electron deficient. And then the other component that needs to happen in this is that we need to have a very strong electronegative element with lone pairs that is bound to the rest of a molecule here. And this element that has lone pairs on it may have three lone pairs, may have two lone pairs, may be bound to a number of different things. This is an element that is electronegative. Element with lone pairs. And when these two come together, the electronegative element with lone pairs is electron rich. And the hydrogen is electron poor. And what happens is there is a bonding interaction where the electrons are donated back to the hydrogen, and they constitute what is called a hydrogen bond. It is stronger than a regular dipole-dipole interaction and only happens between hydrogen and very strongly electronegative elements. Most of the time, we see this between oxygen, nitrogen, and sulfur. Fluorine is the one that is always used within Chem 1A and Chem 1B, and they always say that hydrogen bonds happen between hydrogen and fluorine. Yeah, but in organic compounds, fluorine has to be bound to another element. It can't be bound to hydrogen. And so because fluorine only has one valence, it's really not of interest. So most of the time, these elements X equals nitrogen, sulfur, oxygen. I should actually do it in order of oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur, with increasing strength. Because of the electronegativity, that oxygen is the most electronegative, then nitrogen, then sulfur. And so those atoms need to be there. The same thing here, that we're looking at a hydrogen, which is attached to one of these three elements, either oxygen, nitrogen, or sulfur. And this is a big must. And the reason is that those are electronegative elements, and that's the only way to make hydrogen that electron poor, that when hydrogen is connected to carbon, carbon doesn't have that electronegativity to be able to make hydrogen electron poor. So these types of hydrogen bonds only happen in situations where the hydrogen is connected directly to an oxygen, a nitrogen, or a sulfur. So an example of this, we can look at two compounds as an example. We can look at ethanol and an isomer, which is dimethyl ether. So this is ethanol, or it could be called ethyl alcohol. And this is dimethyl ether. They are both C2H6O, but they have very different physical properties. So when I look at them, the boiling point of the ethanol is 78.4 degrees. But the boiling point of the dimethyl ether is minus 23, and it's a gas at room temperature. You have to cool it down to minus 23 degrees before it condenses into a liquid. Conversely, ethanol is a liquid at room temperature, and you have to increase it almost to 80 degrees before it boils. So what is it about these two structures that are so different in terms of their intermolecular attractive forces and the strength of the forces that are going on here? What we see is that ethanol, if I draw it in this way, ethanol will hydrogen bond because of the oxygen. Actually, I'm going to draw it out because I need to show you this part. And I want it to be absolutely clear. That the hydrogen bond is occurring between the lone pairs of the oxygen and the hydrogen, which is electron deficient. It only occurs here, not between any of the other hydrogens. And the reason is that the other hydrogens are all nonpolar. Each one of these little hydrogens that are next to the carbon, these all have little tiny partial positives, almost nothing. Because the dipole moment with the carbon is very small. Carbon's electronegativity, remember, carbon equals 2.5, hydrogen equals 2.1, and oxygen equals 3.5, much more electronegative. And so here I have a very big electronegative minus, partial minus, and here I have a very big partial positive, which is lining up to that minus. And that's why I get that H bond between the oxygen and the hydrogen. For diethyl ether, there is no hydrogen which is partial positive. It has the oxygen. Great. The oxygen is wonderful. But without the partner, it cannot H bond to another molecule like itself. The only thing it can do is it can do dipole-dipole. And that's it. I should say too, that when a molecule does dipole-dipole, it can also do van der Waals. When a molecule can do H-bonding, it can do dipole-dipole and van der Waals. That a molecule that has the forces, the highest forces, has all the forces below it, and all those forces still interact. But it's those really strong forces, like H-bonding, that require so much energy that really dramatically increase the boiling point. And so this would be small dipole here, and this is going to be dipole-dipole. Can't H-bond. And the reason that it can't H bond is because each one of these has a very tiny partial positive. It does not have enough of a partial positive. It is not electron hungry enough to want to bind with the oxygen. And so it just cannot do H bonding. So it's important to recognize this motif right here, that we're looking at the oxygen and that hydrogen, which is bound to it, which is the important motif that allows for H bonding. Let me follow that up with another example. Let's look at an example of three compounds . I'm going to truncate these structures a little bit to make them a little bit easier to draw. And one more that I'll put in here. Okay, so these are three amines. And this one is trimethyl. This is methyl ethylamine. And the last one is propylamine. Let's just call them A, B, and C to make it a little bit easier. Which one of these do you think is going to have the lowest boiling point? So in here, in asking which of these has the lowest boiling point, what we're asking is, these are all isomers, so they are all C3H9N. They all have the same formula. There is some branching going on, but branching is not the main effect that's happening within these molecules. What's that?
Is it A?
Sophia, you're cutting off a little bit on my feed. Sorry.
Sorry, I said, is it A?
It is A. A has the lowest. Do you want to explain why?
Because there's no hydrogens that are bonded to the nitrogen. And if there was, like in the other two, then they would be electron hungry enough to want to hydrogen bond.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so what's going on here is this guy, each of these has hydrogens that can hydrogen bond. And so both of these two can H bond. That means that they are going to have higher boiling points, and this one cannot H bond. And by not H bonding, it can only do dipole-dipole. And so what we find is that those boiling points, this one is 3.5 degrees Celsius. The methyl ethylamine is 37. And the other one is 49. And so we can see by the boiling points that that is true. A has the lowest boiling point. And the reason that it's A is because A cannot H bond. A only has dipole-dipole, whereas B and C both H bond. Okay, that's good. Thank you, Sophia. All right, let's make a shift. Let's get into structural formulas. I'm gonna go to, we can start here. This is good. So what we've been doing so far is we've been drawing structural formulas that are full Lewis structures. So just to be clear, as we start to get into structural formulas, we have things like CH2O, which is a molecular formula. We can take that and we can draw that into a Lewis structure. And that's what we've been drawing so far, are these Lewis structures, which really are structural formulas. Or a type of structural formula. As we get into formulas that are a little bit larger, and we look at something like C2, I think I need H7. And as a molecular formula, there's a couple of different structural formulas that I can draw for it. And these being related by having the same molecular formula are said to be structural isomers. But this starts to get to be a really clunky way to draw. And with the molecular formulas, it's unclear what structural formula it is that I'm looking at. So these two would be said to be constitutional isomers, is the way that we refer to them. Constitutional or structural isomers. And so what we start doing is including in the molecular formula some atom connectivity that helps to tell us what isomer it is that we're actually looking at. So what we can do is we could say CH3, CH2, and H2. Or we would say CH3, NH CH3, or sometimes what they'll do is they'll say CH3, they'll put parentheses around it, they'll subscript a 2, and then do NH at the end. And that these are still molecular formulas that are condensed in a way. Condensed structural formulas. Or we could say that they're molecular formulas that have some structure in it. So as we start to get into a slightly more complicated structure, we can look at C5H12. And we can draw that C5H12 out. We'll draw a single isomer of C5H12. We could do the full Lewis structure. we can do a condensed formula. So a condensed formula here may be CH3, CH2 with lines in between, CH, CH3, and then coming out this way, CH3. Or sometimes what they'll do is they'll take and they'll write it this way, CH3, CH2, and then they'll put the CH brackets CH3 and then CH3. Or sometimes even the CH3 twice. These are all different ways of doing condensed formulas. And so we have the molecular, the Lewis structure, and then we have some condensed formulas. All of these have problems with them. The problems with the molecular formulas, this is not specific. The Lewis structure is specific, but takes a lot of time. And space. And these condensed formulas are also clunky and require a lot of time to write down and can be confusing. So when I say can be confusing, I'm thinking about this type of notation where it's unclear what the atom connectivity is unless you've really looked at a lot of condensed formulas to try to figure it out. So then how do we communicate? What we tend to do is we tend to communicate in what's called a bond line formula. So the bond line formula allows us to be able to draw the molecule, and I drew it upside down of what I wanted, allows us to be able to draw the molecule in a very fast, very condensed way. And is the preferred way. So that bond line formula says everything that these others say. It has the atom connectivity that is up here. It has the atom connectivity of these condensed structural formulas, but it's super fast and super easy to write. And the bond line formula is the preferred, fast, easy communication. And in order to understand bond line formulas, what we need to do is we need to sort of take a number of different molecules and convert them into bond line formulas to understand sort of what's going on. But basically what happens is in a bond line formula, at each junction, as we bring the lines together, signifies a carbon. And so a carbon sits at the union of lines coming from different directions. The carbons, when nothing else is attached to them, are considered to have hydrogens attached to fill out the octets. And so we can take a look and we can see how many things are connected to a particular carbon, like this carbon here is only connected to one other thing. And therefore, carbon must have four bonds to it at all times. The other three must be hydrogens. This carbon is connected to two points. Being connected to two points, this carbon has two of its valencies filled. The additional two must be hydrogens. This carbon is connected to three other points. Three valencies filled, one additional valency must be a hydrogen. And so we can interpret the bond line structure to look at it and know exactly how many hydrogens are connected to each carbon just by looking and seeing how many lines are coming together. So let's take a couple of structures and show how we would convert them into bond line formulas. We can actually go back and forth. We could take some bond line formulas and expand them out as well so that we see how they're written out. Let's take and start with a hydrocarbon first. And let's do, this would be 2-methylpropane. In 2-methylpropane, as I expand it out, what I want to do is take that longest carbon chain that is 3 carbons. And when I put down my first line, I say 2. The reason I say 2 is because a line represents the connection between 2 atoms. So if this is atom number 1 and this is atom number 2, this is 1 and this is 2. I put down my second line and I say 3. So first line, when I draw that first line out, I'm going to do it one more time. I count, not starting 1, I count 2 when I draw the line, because as I said, I'm going 1 and 2. So we start counting at 2. Second line, I count 3. And I always do them at angles, approximately a 60 degree angle. That's number 3. I go back and I look and say, where is the additional carbon there? The additional carbon is connected to number 2. That's going to be carbon number 4. And so I draw my line from 2 straight up, and that's number 4. That structure represents the same molecule. And I don't need to draw the hydrogens. The hydrogens are implied in the structure. If there are elements other than carbon or hydrogen, then it must be explicitly shown. So if I want to show a molecule that has an oxygen, maybe 2 carbons, and then a nitrogen, and I want to do this in bond line formula, the oxygen and the nitrogen must be explicitly shown. So what I would do is I would draw the bond and I would say 2. This would correspond to number 1 and number 2, the 2 carbons. And then at an angle, I draw coming off of number 2, the oxygen. And we try to approximate good VSEPR bond angles. And then coming off of number 2, so this is 1 and 2. Coming off of number 2, I have the nitrogen. And then I try to keep the good bond angles and add in the lone pairs. The lone pairs are not essential. Oftentimes, the lone pairs are left off. And oftentimes, the bond between the hydrogen and the hetero atom are also left off. They are implied, they're still there. We just don't draw them all the time. So if we want to work backwards from this, and we want to take a structure backwards, we would start with the Lewis structure. And you can see how fast it may be to draw the Lewis structure. The Lewis structure is very quick to draw. And then when we want to interpret that into a full Lewis structure, we would number out the molecule so that we see how many carbons there are and the atom connectivity. Pick the longest carbon chain and work from the longest carbon chain. There are 4 carbons in the longest carbon chain. You can even go back and number them sequentially, and then look and see what is connected to each carbon. At carbon number 2, I have the oxygen and hydrogen. at carbon number four, or at number three, I have another carbon, and it can go up or down. It doesn't matter which direction you draw it. Actually, I'm going to make it go down because it doesn't matter which direction you draw it, and that's going to make my structure a little bit easier to draw. Now, I've included everything that's been shown in the bond line formula, but I need to go back and need to look and say, how many hydrogens does each carbon need? Each carbon must maintain four bonds. So in order to maintain four bonds, I add a number of bonds to it to make sure that each carbon has four bonds around it. Each open line then represents the bond to a hydrogen. And I can complete the structure. This is an intermediate step that allows me to be able to then figure out how many carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens the molecule has. And I can figure out what its molecular formula is. Sometimes the molecular formula is important, or knowing how many hydrogens something has is really important. We could do the same thing for things that are not linear. So we could take a structure that is a Lewis structure, a bond line structure, that we want to then convert into a full Lewis structure and figure out what its molecular formula is. So this one starts off with, and again, I would number them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. This one is a six-membered ring system. And so I would start by drawing six carbons out in the ring. Going through and numbering them in the exact same way that I did for the bond line formula. And then including the carbon that comes off of carbon number one, we can call this one number seven. And then everybody has to get a complement of four bonds. So to include those four bonds, we look and say each carbon must have an additional number of bonds, and those bonds must be the hydrogens. But I think you can see, but going back and forth between the Lewis structure and the bond line, that the bond line is just so much faster. And the bond line formula is the way that we traditionally communicate within organic chemistry. Again, we can take that down now that this one would be a C7H14. That we can count out all of the hydrogens at that point. Okay, so now that we're in bond line formulas, now we can do faster structures. And now we can start to talk about isomers a little bit. So if we take a formula that is C3H6O, we can look at all of the different bond lines for it. And I don't know that I want to do, what do I want to do, isomers? And I don't want to do fully isomers yet here. I'm going to do a bunch of structures for you. And we'll see how many ways we can put this together. How many isomers are there? So this one, when we get to alkanes, we'll formally do isomers within alkanes, and I'll have you drawing a lot of isomers in that section. This is just in order to be able to look at bond line formula, what can we do? One of the things that we can do is we can look at this and we can start to draw structures. Putting the carbons in a row with the oxygen, there are only six hydrogens. So if I put this many hydrogens on it, what I find, that's 3, 4, 5. Oh, and I missed a carbon. Let's put all the carbons in a row. That would be the 3 carbons. There's my oxygen. This formula is C3H8O. So this formula is not working. It has too many hydrogens in it, which means that we need to get rid of 2 hydrogens. The only way to get rid of 2 hydrogens is to realize that I need to make a double bond in this molecule someplace, and that a double bond represents the loss of 2 hydrogens. If I take 2 hydrogens away and I stick a bond between them, then that's the way that I get rid of 2 hydrogens. Structures with double bonds output in or a ring is another way to get rid of 2 hydrogens, is to get rid of 2 of the hydrogens and then connect them together in a ring is another way to be able to get the unit of unsaturation is what we call it. So structures here, once I start drawing structures, if I were to draw them fully out, it would take a long time. But what I can do is I can draw those bond line formulas. And those bond line formulas allow me to be able to go through and draw structures. First, where the oxygen has a double bond, then maybe where the carbon has a double bond. Moving the double bond along the carbon chain, maybe going to branching. Slipping the oxygen inside of the chain. Going to a ring structure where the oxygen is outside. Going to a ring structure where the oxygen is inside. Going to a ring structure where everything is in the ring. And you can see that I can start to get a lot of different structures, and I can draw them so much faster using the bond line formulas than I ever could trying to write them out this way. It also removes a lot of the confusion in when I start to branch things and things go up or go down or twist or turn. It gets rid of a lot of that confusion because now you can start to see structures that are identical and structures that are different. And the best thing to always do is to go through 1, 2, 3 carbons. One, let's put, this would be 1, 2, and 3. 1, 2, and 3. 1, 2, and 3. 1, 2, and 3. Let's go to this one, 1, 2, and 3 out that way. 1, 2, and 3 on the ring system. This one would be 1, 2, and 3 would be out here. And then finally 1, 2, and 3 there. And if you go through the numbering system and you look at molecules that may be slightly confusing, for instance, double bond between 2 and 3 versus double bond between 1 and 2, where oxygen is on 1 each time. Double bond between 1 and 2, oxygen on 2. Double bond between 1 and 2, oxygen on 2, carbon off of oxygen. And so it allows you to be able to see the structures a little bit easier in this bond line, in this condensed bond line formula, which is why we push the bond lines to such a degree. Resonance is the next topic, but I'm almost hesitant. I'm not gonna do resonance fully. I think what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna give you a couple of molecular formulas, bond line formulas. And I'm going to ask you to figure out how many carbons, oxygens, and nitrogens, and hydrogens the structures have. And then we'll talk about resonance as where we're going next. So let me give you a bond line formula. Let's call this one A. And let me give you another one. Let's call this one B. Why don't you give me the molecular formula for A? Tell me how many carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens. And I'll give you a hint here. I can't see what you're doing, but if you're not drawing, then you're not doing it right. If you're sitting there and you're trying to do this in your head, you are going to go down in flames. Usually when I'm in class, this is one of the things where I first do, where I put something on the board and I ask you guys a question. And I look at the class and I look at everybody staring at the board. Staring at the board and staring at the problem does not help you in any way. If you are not drawing, you are not doing it right. You need to draw out the structure and you need to start putting in the hydrogens, placing them in, making sure that each carbon has four bonds to it, and then numbering and counting. It is the only way to not make mistakes. It takes a good amount of time to learn to be able to do this in your head. And even those people who can do it in their head, you're counting so many things, it's not worth it. You should be drawing. Always drawing and always numbering. It is one of the main survival skills of organic chemistry. When you get it, throw it in the chat. What's the molecular formula for A? Feel like I need a little Jeopardy music here. Do 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 do. Are you guys working on this? I might even just be talking to myself here. All right, first one up, C10H18O2. Anybody else want to agree, disagree? I don't know what the answer is yet. I haven't done it yet. I haven't started drawing. I was waiting for you guys to give me some answers and see if we agree or not. So on this first one, I'm going to go through and number the carbons really quick. This is carbon number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. So it is indeed a C10. And it is also indeed O2. The question is in the hydrogens, and the hydrogens are always the hard part. So how many hydrogens are there? Each carbon must maintain 4 bonds. So every carbon that has 2 bonds will have 2 hydrogens on it. Every carbon that has 3 bonds will have 1. And every carbon that has 1 bond will have 3 hydrogens. So now all the hydrogens are demonstrated. What I gotta do is not forget to count this one out here. So this is number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. I think I'm at 16 instead of 18. I'm gonna recount again. This is 1. There are no carbons on, there are no hydrogens on carbon 2. So this would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. I'm seeing 16. And we can verify that. There's a formula that allows us to verify that. Each ring subtracts 2 carbons. Each double bond, each ring subtracts 2 hydrogens. Each double bond subtracts 2 hydrogens. So there are 1, 2 double bonds and 1 ring. So I should be subtracting 6 from a saturated formula. Saturated would be C10H2N+2. That would equal H2 × 10+2, which would equal H22. And then I've got to subtract out 6 from that amount. 6 from 22 is indeed 16. And so we're showing the right number there. We've counted them all correctly.
Can you say that one more time where you said the double bond? You were saying something about the double bond. I didn't even see it till now and I couldn't hear.
Yeah, it's something that I do when we get to isomers and drawing isomers and alkenes. It's called the index of unsaturation, or there might be another name for it too. I usually call it the units of unsaturation. Mm-hmm. And for a saturated molecule, the number of carbons is used with a lowercase n. The H is 2 times that many plus 2 plus the number of nitrogens in the molecule subtract the number of halogens. And that will tell you how many hydrogens the molecule should have if it were saturated, if it had no rings and no double bonds.
And the X represents halogens, you said?
That's right. Okay. And then each ring and each double bond represent the loss of 2 hydrogens. And I should say the loss of 2 hydrogens from that saturated number.
Also, another question, does it matter in the order that you label the carbons? Like instead of going around the ring clockwise, if you would have went anti-clockwise or counterclockwise, would that have been wrong?
No. When you're numbering, what you're numbering for right now is not nomenclature. What you're numbering for is just to count the number of carbons. There's no right or wrong in the numbering right now. When we get into nomenclature and we start to name molecules, then the numbering matters a great deal. Then there is definitely a right way to number. But for right now, I would say number in any way that allows you to see the number of carbons in the molecule.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you.
Okay, so let's do that second one. If you haven't done B, let's do B really quickly. Let's get the number of carbons first. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13. Looks like I've counted them all. This is definitely a C13. It has one oxygen. It has one nitrogen. And the question is, how many hydrogens does it have? So here's where we need to be careful again. By going through and adding in for each carbon the right number of hydrogens. When a carbon has three bonds to it, three lines to it, regardless of whether they're double bonds or triple bonds, whatever they are, when there are three lines coming together, that carbon only has one hydrogen. Number seven is another spot where three lines come together. It has only one hydrogen. Number six has two lines. Therefore, it has two hydrogens. Number five has three lines. So it has a hydrogen. Number four has four lines. So it has no hydrogens. Number two has three lines. That means it has a hydrogen. Number three only has one line. So it has three hydrogens. Number one has one line. It has three hydrogens. Number 13 has three, so it has one hydrogen. Number 12 has three, so it has one hydrogen. Number 11 has three, so it has one hydrogen. And I've gone through and I've done them all. Now I need to count them really carefully. So this is two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, 9, 10, 13, 16, 17, 18, 19, and I'm back where I started. 19 hydrogens is what that molecule should have. We can confirm that again. I can count how many it should have being saturated. And then I can subtract the number for the rings and the double bonds. So for saturated, it's a 13. So it would have H2 times 13 plus 2 plus the 1 for the nitrogen. There are no halogens in this. So this would equal C13 H26 plus 3 would be 29. And I'm going to subtract from that 29 2 times the number of rings and double bonds. So I have 2 different rings and 3 double bonds. So that's 5 in total. 2 times 5 is 10. I'm going to subtract 10 from this value. And that's going to give me H19. And that is indeed the number of hydrogens that I have. So this was 2 times 2 rings plus 3 double bonds. That's how I got 10. As the number of hydrogens that I was subtracting. And so we've confirmed that we did the right number of hydrogens in that molecule. Notice that I could get the right number of hydrogens without ever actually having to count them all by using the formula. That one of the ways that I could go through and do this is use the formula to get them. However, it is critically important that you recognize where there is one hydrogen, where there is two, and where there is three, and where there is none. That is an incredibly important skill. All right, resonance is the next big topic. When we come back, on Thursday, we'll start resonance. And resonance is like one of the biggest topics that we ever do. It is one of the major three answers to almost everything within organic chemistry. So there are three main answers to almost every problem in organic chemistry. The answer is either resonance, induction, or sterics. And those are three of the main answers to almost every single problem, which can tell you that if that's one of the three main answers to every problem that you're going to study for a year, resonance is a very big topic. And it takes a lot of practice to understand what resonance is and how to do it correctly. It's basically a model system for looking at the molecule and understanding the electron flow within the molecule, where the electrons are partial positive, where the carbons are partial positive, where they're partial minus, and just how the electrons move throughout the molecule. They give us a picture of what the molecule actually looks like. And that model system is even more important for understanding molecules that have charges in them, both positive charges, negative charges, and molecules that may have free radicals in them, and how those charges are distributed throughout the molecule. So it's critically important for assessing relative stability of molecules, which is going to play into every other area that we study. It's going to play into acid-base, it's going to play into reactivity, it's going to play into all different kinds of chemical reactivity, and we're going to assess them all through this model of resonance. So if you can read ahead a little bit and read a little bit on resonance, it would be a good thing before the next lecture on Thursday. And then we'll get into looking at different ways of looking at resonance structures, different ways of pushing the electrons. And I break it down into patterns. And so we'll look at push patterns and pull patterns, hinge pin patterns. We'll talk about a lot of different types of patterns and how to recognize them within structures. That's all coming up for Thursday. So critically important lecture coming up on Thursday. For now, what I would say, it's time to start practicing bond line formulas and working any number of problems that you can find in the textbook. Utilizing bond line formulas is the next big thing, because as we go into resonance, we're going to do it all through bond line formula. And so you want to make sure that your bond line formulas are strong. So between now and Thursday, work bond line formulas. Find full Lewis structures, convert them into bond line. Find bond line, convert them back into Lewis structures, back and forth, back and forth. That's what you need to be doing. All right. That's it. I'm going to call it quits for now. I'll stay on the line if you have any questions. Remember, I'll be back for office hours, I think at 1 o'clock here pretty quickly. So 1 to 2 office hours. And I'll see you guys later.